My talk is Homological Link Invariants from Flora Theory. Thank you for the introduction. This is joint work with Mina Aganagic and Miroslav Rapchuk, and it's going to appear very, very soon. So I'll start at the beginning of this story, which started in the 1980s with the discovery of the Jones polynomial. This is a polynomial link invariant defined by this gain relation I have shown here. So the way one would use this is you'd start with a 2D projection of a knot or a link, and then locally you can result change an overcrossing to an undercrossing or vice versa using this relationship until you are left with the, just the unknot times some polynomial in Q. And so in this way, you can reduce any knot to the unknot times the polynomial in Q, and that polynomial you're left with is the Jones polynomial. And notably, it's always going to have integer coefficients. So here's an example. This is the Hopf link, and it would have that Jones polynomial. And so then, very shortly afterwards, Witten gave a physics interpretation of the Jones polynomial coming from Chern-Simons theory at level K with gauge group SU2. And so the way he did this is you put Wilson lines in your theories where the Wilson lines trace out the knots. They're colored by the fundamental representation of SU2, and then the partition function of your theory recovers the Jones polynomial after you identify Q, the variable of the Jones polynomial, with this expression in terms of the Chern-Simons level. So in Chern-Simons theory, the level will be quantized, but Q doesn't necessarily have to be a root of unity for these knot polynomials. And then one can easily imagine that by varying the gauge grouping representation, you can get a whole family of link invariants, and these are called quantum group invariants. And they were very quickly developed by, say, Rashtutikin and Tarive in the context of CFTs and moving away from Chern-Simons theory. And so these quantum group invariants are very well studied. And the next part of our story comes from the categorification of quantum link invariants, the first example of which is called Kovanov homology. And so Kovanov homology is also a link invariant in the sense that all of these vector spaces are link invariants. And so we would assign to a knot or link a collection of bigraded vector spaces such that the Euler characteristic coincides with the Jones polynomial. And so here, I is going to be the homological grading, and that's just going to get you the signs in the Jones polynomial. And then this grading J, I'll call the equivariant grading, and we'll see it come back later, is going to give you the exponential of Q in the Jones polynomial. And the dimensions of these vector spaces recover the integer coefficients. And so one would expect that the same way we can categorify the Jones polynomial, we can categorify any polynomial link invariant, such that the Euler characteristic gives back, say, a quantum group invariant. And so this program's already been pursued by a lot of people. After Kovanov, Kovanov-Rosansky homology was discovered that works for the fundamental rep of SUN. And then following an entirely different train, not Floer homology, categorifies the Alexander polynomial. And actually, our categorifications are going to be more in the spirit of not Floer homology. And then finally, Ben Webster proposed a general categorification for quantum group invariants in 2013. And his categorification is purely algebraic. And so the longstanding problem was to find this general categorification of link homology, and one would ideally want to find a construction with an explicit geometric and physical origin. This was solved by Mina Aganagic in recent work using homological mirror symmetry. And so it has two sides. Her 2020 paper develops the B side, and the 2021 paper develops the A side. I'm mostly going to be talking about the A side and the theory living there, and mostly going to be developing it independently of homological mirror symmetry and giving a self-contained proof that we actually get link invariants within the A model. So as an outline, I'll briefly review Flora theory and the A model that we need, and then I'll explain how to get homological link invariants. And then it turns out this theory for us is completely solvable, and so I'll give an example of how we can solve this theory for both GL1/1 and SU2. And I'll extend it to other Lie algebras and Lie superalgebras. I guess I should mention the stories I've told you about previous categorifications are only in the case of normal Lie algebras. So the generalization to any superalgebra besides GL1 is fairly new. And then I'll explain how we know we have topological invariance. So Floer theory is really a theory about counting the intersections of Lagrangian submanifolds. And it's used namely to formulate knot Floer homology. So if we have a, say we have a 2n-dimensional symplectic manifold, and then a Lagrangian submanifold is going to be an n-dimensional submanifold such that the symplectic form vanishes restricted to it. And so if we have two Lagrangians, we can associate a chain complex generated by their intersection points and going to be equipped with a differential Q. And so what I'm going to tell you is for compact Lagrangians, but we'll actually need a generalization for non-compact Lagrangians as well. And so the differential is going to count certain cytohomomorphic maps from a disk into our target space. And so what these maps do is, say we have two intersection points of our Lagrangians, the image of our map should be a disk that has the two intersection points on the boundary and connects them. And there are certain restrictions that they should be cytohomomorphic, and there's a finite energy condition. And so these disks can be quite technical to count. And another way we can think of this is that the intersection points would be perturbative ground states, and then the disks would be instanton corrections. And so then if we take the Floer homology of this complex, counting all of these such disks, this would be the Floer complex. And it would be invariant under Hamiltonian isotopy of either of our Lagrangians. And so this theory is both developed extensively in math under the name Hegard-Floer theory, but then it also has a physics counterpart, which would be the A model. And this is what we'll be using here. And so for us specifically, the surface we want is going to be some number of symmetric products of an infinite cylinder. And this is the theory where our knots will live. We're also going to need punctures on our cylinder for a potential. But essentially, we want to think of the space as the configuration space of colored points on a punctured infinite cylinder. And the different color punctures and different color points will correspond to different roots of our Lie algebra. So in the example I have shown here, I would have a Lie algebra that has three different roots. So for example, this could be SU4. And say all of the punctures would be colored by corresponding highest weights. The punctures would be the x's. And then the dots would be the points on our configuration space. So I have two red, so that would correspond to SIM2, and then just one blue and one green. So this would be SIM2A cross A cross A. And so this is how you really want to think of it. So like projecting all of your products of cylinders onto just one cylinder, just by way of to look at them, really. And so then we're also going to put a potential on our cylinder. And so our coordinate little y on our cylinder is going to have two coordinates, alpha, which is going to label the different copies of the symmetric products. And that's going to correspond. So alpha will be however many roots you have of your Lie algebra. And then dA is just some value that we'll fix depending on the knot later. Our potential is going to have a few different components. These WA components, so there will be one WA for each root of your Lie algebra. And this is just, the only purpose of this is really it's going to give you singularities around either end of the cylinder. And then W0 is the more complicated function. And this lambda0 is just going to be some parameter. And that's going to be related to the Q of your knot. The equivariant grading, the J grading for knot homology, is really going to arise from this potential. So I'll tell you what W is. I have it shown here. I guess it's a bit complicated, but some of the important things to point out is the EA are your roots, and then the mu are going to be highest weights coloring each of your punctures. And also, as I said, the points on your cylinder will be associated to roots of your algebra. So the takeaways from this potential are that one of the y's are the points, remember. So if any of the points y wrap around a puncture, the potential is going to change values, provided that the root corresponding to that point is connected on the Dinkin diagram to the weight coloring the puncture. And then similarly, if two punctures pass around each other on your cylinder, if their roots are connected on the Dinkin diagram, you'll also have a change in the value of the potential. And so that's really what the potential is here for, is because it's non-single valued and you get these changes of branch when certain points wrap around each other. So to give you a more digestible example, I'll just consider SU2 with four punctures labeled by the fundamental weight and two marked points. So I have my four punctures and my two marked points. The marked points are the Ys up there. So I have just SIM2 because I have a single root of SU2. And I'm going to choose D1 equals 2, which corresponds to my two points. And then my potential here is fairly simple. And so if either of the Ys pass around each other, it'll change branches. Or if either of the Ys wrap around a puncture, that would also change branches. And so then in our theory, we have these things called A-brains, which are supported on Lagrangian submanifolds. And so in this particular theory, they're either going to look like one-dimensional curves connecting pairs of punctures, or they'll be closed one-dimensional curves, figure eights or ovals, depending on your gauge group, that will encircle pairs of punctures. So this figure I have shown here would, again, be for SU2. And so here's some examples I have. And then, as I said before, flora theory comes from counting intersection points of the brains with the action of some differential. And so that's how we're going to define morphisms of the brains I showed you on the previous page using flora theory. And then, like I said, we have our two gradings, the equivariant grading and the homological grading. So this equivariant grading is going to come from the non-single valuedness of W. It's going to have, we'll have like J0 and then other ones. J0 is going to be what recovers this Q grading of the Jones polynomial, and that's going to be what I was trying to talk about with the potential earlier about wrapping around punctures or exchanging points. And then we'll also have the Maslov gradings coming from the change of the holomorphic top form on Y. And so both of these gradings can be calculated on the pullback of a disk. So these disks are the same disks that I said that contributed to the differential. Although there are specific conditions for a disk to contribute to a differential, but you can use more general disks just to calculate the relative grading of two intersection points. So to calculate the relative grading, I would pick out two intersection points, find a disk that maps between them, and hypothetically take the pullback to this disk of these quantities, but it turns out there's a much simpler combinatorial formula to actually compute these, just in terms of like whether there's punctures in the disks and the angles on the corners. So in practice, one doesn't actually have to use these formulas once you have the combinatorial formula. So to get homological link invariance, the easiest way to do it is start with a presentation of a link as a braid closure, and I'm going to show you how to translate this presentation to a configuration of A-brains. So first I want to split the link into cups and caps where the dashed line is. So above the dashed line is just going to be some pairing of intersection points, and below the dashed line I have the same pairing of intersection points, but now they're braided according to the braid on the left picture. So on the left, the two middle strands exchange places twice. And so in the bottom right picture, the two middle punctures would exchange places twice. And so then starting from these cups and caps, I would replace them with certain A-brains. So the exact A-brains I choose will depend on what the group is. So I have some examples here for SU2 and for GL11. And so really, homological mirror symmetry would tell you what caps and cups you want to choose here. But there's sort of a recipe for figuring out what they are, which I'll explain in a bit. So I guess some important things to point out, SU2, you have figure eights. GL11, you have ovals. And then for SU2, so you always want to pair up. These brains should be pairing pairs of punctures colored by a representation and a dual representation. For SU2, the fundamental representation is self-dual, so all your punctures are red. And then for GL11, this fundamental representation is not going to be self-dual, so you're going to have two different color punctures. paired by your caps and cups. So these are the A brains corresponding to my caps and cups. And then to get link homology, I want to overlay them and count their intersection points. So this is my Hoflink example. All I did is I took these caps and cups from the previous page, and I put them on top of each other. And so this BE refers to the braided cup brains, and the I refers to the cap brains. And then the flora complex of these brains is going to be a homological link invariant. So in my picture, I have the flora complex, which is going to be spanned by 8 points. So the reason you can see this is 8 points is this would be on sim 2 of the cylinder. So any point would be a pair of points. So say P1, Q1 would be an intersection point because P and Q both lay on different I brains and they both lay on different figure 8 brains. But for example, like P1, R1 would not be an intersection point because they lay on the same I brain. So that actually wouldn't be a valid point in sim 2 of the cylinder. So once I have this complex spanned by intersection points, hypothetically, I'd want to count holomorphic disks with these particular gradings. So every disk I count would have to have homological degree 1 and equivariant degree 0. And so I have an example here of a domain that may contribute to the holomorphic disk count and may contribute to the differential. So in theory, what I would want to do is I would want to count all such holomorphic disks to get the differential action on the complex I just showed you. And then this would be a homological link invariant. But it turns out that just computing these disks is in general hard. In particular, because this is what happens in knot flora theory, a lot of people have spent a lot of time thinking about how we can count these disks geometrically. And so there are some tricks, some certain knot configurations for knot flora theory where one can count these disks easily, but there's not sort of a general method to know if they contribute or not. And so we're going to translate our problem into something algebraic, where the disk counts are actually manifest using special properties of the A brains. And doing this will be able to provide a general algorithm for computing homological link invariants by explaining what all the brains look like in our category. So the way we do this is by using special brains known as Lipschitz thimbles that generate the category in the sense that every A brain is going to be able to be written as a complex of thimbles. There's two types, left thimbles and right thimbles. The left thimbles will be downward gradient flows of the real part of the potential. And so in our case, these thimbles will just look like real line Lagrangians passing between pairs of punctures. And so the thimbles will also be colored by roots, just like the points. And so depending on what surface you're on, you're going to have some number of the products of these straight line thimbles will actually define your thimbles. And then we'll also have these dual thimbles, which are the right thimbles, upward gradient flows, and they will be connecting pairs of punctures, such as I have shown here. And so they're dual in the sense that the left and right thimbles will only ever intersect at the intersection point, which will be the critical point of the potential. And they will only intersect if they correspond to the same critical point. And so only in the sense they'll correspond to the same critical point will they have non-trivial morphisms between them, and otherwise there will be no morphisms between them. And so in order to easily calculate our complexes, we're going to use this duality of the thimbles. So I think, as I mentioned before, what I was explaining really only worked for compact thimbles. But now some of these thimbles are non-compact, so we have to revisit what we mean by morphisms between thimbles. And what we need now is to look at something called the wrapped Foucaille category. So we want to look at the intersection points after wrapping one of the thimbles. And so wrapping the thimbles, either you can think of it as gradient flows of a slightly rotated potential, or you can actually think of the wrapped thimble will make this small real angle zeta with the cylinder. And so it'll wrap infinitely many times around the ends of the cylinder. And so calculating the morphisms between two thimbles, you want to calculate the morphisms between one of the thimbles and the wrapped version of the other thimbles. You'll see that you'll get infinitely many intersection points. But because of our potential, wrapping around the end of the cylinder changes the equivariant grading. So all of these intersection points will, in fact, have a different equivariant grading. And that will give us a way to sort out which intersection points we actually want to use. And so then we can get a higher structure by looking at, say, intersection points of three thimbles. And this will give us a product on the morphisms of the thimbles. So I have an example here of three thimbles and their corresponding three intersection points. And you can see that they make a triangle. So this is what's called a holomorphic triangle. And this is going to give us a product structure on the algebra of morphisms. So for example, I can translate this triangle I have shown here into the equation I have shown at the bottom of the screen. And there is the sort of top formula I have will tell you what order these three generators should go to translate into the algebra relation. But sort of the important takeaway is there is a geometric way to count triangles to turn these morphisms into an algebra. And then these morphisms, sort of writing down the algebra, I think can be difficult to know how to package all the information. And so one of the best ways is as a strand algebra on the cylinder, where the strand algebra is generated by certain bits. I have three such bits shown here, where the red lines would correspond to the punctures, and the blue lines would correspond to the thimbles. And so you want to think of these three bits. The first one would be a thimble passing one direction across the puncture. The second bit would be a thimble passing the other direction across the puncture. And then the third bit would be two thimbles exchanging places. And multiplication is simply given by stacking diagrams. So actually, this relation I have shown on the very bottom is going to correspond to the triangle I had shown on the previous page. So if we say, look, OK, so the previous page had four punctures. And we can say maybe this first element starts from a thimble between the first two punctures and ends at a thimble between the last two punctures. So that's the point I called A24, which starts on this sort of medium blue-ish thimble and then ends on the dark blue thimble. So it starts on the thimble between the first two and ends on the thimble between the last two. And so in this way, I can translate all of these morphisms to diagrams, and then count triangles to get these relationships between them. And so then using this algebra, I can write any brain as a chain complex of thimbles, where the maps in the chain complex are elements of this thimble algebra that I just showed you. And so then in this way, we're able to describe link homology purely algebraically by starting, is that a question, or are you just?
How do you find a resolution?
That's what I'm going to explain. So once we can find the resolutions, which is sort of the difficult part, and then link homology will just follow from that. So we have sort of a recipe for finding resolutions. So one-dimensional brains can be written down purely from geometry. I'll show you sort of just geometric way to just write it down from the picture. And then if we remove a certain part of our manifold Y, which corresponds to the diagonal and also the divisor of the punctures we'll see, we can just construct resolutions of brains on this simpler surface from products of one-dimensional brains. And it's fairly simple using like product structure on chain complexes. And then the last step is we want to extend this resolution on Y without the diagonal to the entire manifold Y. And this is the most involved step. But the reason this works for us is because the algebra on Y without the diagonal, going from like the set of thimbles is the same with or without the diagonal, but it's only with this, there's a certain deformation in the algebra that will take you from without the diagonal to turning on the diagonal, and this will only change the algebra elements. And so we're able to start with the deformation without the diagonal and find the deformation of the differential that extends the resolution to our full space Y. And then this deformation will be unique up to quasi-isomorphism, and that will give us a resolution of the brain on the full space. That's what I just said. So I'll give a few examples. I'll give the example in both GL11 and SU2, which are the two examples we've worked out. And then in theory, our approach should extend to any Lie algebra or super Lie algebra with the restriction that it becomes computationally intensive in the sense that you end up having to solve a lot of equations. So for GL11, remember I said we have two different color punctures. So we're going to have the bits shown up here, where the red and green are the two different color punctures. And so this algebra here is fairly simple. There are two relationships where this black strand can be either a thimble or either color puncture. So it's saying that I can drag an intersection of thimbles past a puncture. Or if a thimble, basically the second relation corresponds to I can't have a disk that passes through a puncture, and that sets that disk to zero. And so then finally, our relations get a little more complicated because we also have a differential. So in the same way that we could get a product on our algebra by counting certain disks, we can also get a differential by counting particular other disks. And so this differential just acts by uncrossing the strands and by introducing this parameter h bar. And so h bar is the parameter that's going to keep track of the intersection with diagonal. Hypothetically, we could set it to 1, but it's useful to leave in because it controls this deformation that we care about. So if I set h bar to 0, it just gives the algebra with the diagonal removed. And then we will turn on h bar, and that will give us a resolution in the full theory. So here's some examples of just the geometric way to find resolution. So remember I said the caps for GL11 were ovals. And so this cylinder now is sort of, I think, rotated 90 degrees from some of the pictures I showed you previously. So now instead of our thimbles being horizontal, our thimbles are now vertical. So we see we have two thimbles here, and then two maps between them, which I've labeled in terms of the strand algebra. And so you can see that literally, like if I imagine gluing these thimbles at infinity where these maps turn on, I recover the oval. And so this is sort of the geometric way. Formally, this would be sort of taking cones over Lagrangians, but it just looks like actually making what it looks like in a picture. And then we can translate this picture into a projective resolution. So the thimble on the left would be, say, T1, and the thimble on the right would be T3. And then we have these two maps that go between them. And so I did tell you that these were chain complexes, but in fact, for super algebras, they're going to be twisted chain complexes, which the main difference here is that, so normally in a chain complex, your differential is just going to decrease the homological degree by 1, but in a twisted chain complex, the differential can map from any degree to any other degree. So here, T1 would be in degree 1, T3 would be in degree 0, and we truly would have a map that goes from degree 0 to 1. And this is going to arise because some of the homological degrees of the algebra elements are not going to be 0. Okay, so taking this cap brain, we can then recover, say, the unknot homology. So naively, you would expect that I just intersect this cap and cup to get the unknot homology. And because, remember I said these I brains were dual to the T brains, so I too will just pick out whatever T2 thimbles are in my resolution, but there's no T2 thimbles in my resolution. So the morphisms between these brains are just 0. And so we don't actually recover anything interesting. And that's because it turns out that, in particular for the GL11 theory, as is known from knot floor homology, you have to cut a strand to get a non-zero knot invariant. So cutting a strand corresponds to removing one set of cup and cap brains. So if I were to take this top diagram, which would have two cup brains and two cat brains, and then I remove one of each, so I remove an eye brain and I remove an oval, I get the picture shown in the bottom. And so this would be the I3 brain now that we're intersecting with. And if we recall, my complex for this oval had one copy of T3. And so intersecting with the I3 brain is just going to pick out this one copy of T3. And so at the level of complexes, we get one intersection point, which is exactly what we see at the level of brains. So this is sort of a basic first check it's working. So here's my little aside on twist. Yeah.
And that knot.
Oh, for this knot?
It's kind of, you know, so that four brains equals caps and two.
Yeah, so the straight lines will be equal to the caps and the ovals will be the cups.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you move one of each.
Yeah. So my aside on twisted complexes, they're necessary because not all maps in the algebra have homological or Maslov degree zero, which one could find this by doing out all of the holomorphic triangle counting that I explained previously. If you did all of this, you would find that every algebra generator has an associated homological degree and equivariant degree. So in an ordinary chain complex, maps would just go from homological degree k to k minus 1. But now in a twisted complex, they can go from any degree k to l, provided that the homological degree of this map in the differential obeys this equation. So it should be equal to l plus k minus 1. And so I guess you can see that if the homological degree of your differential term is 0, then obviously the differential would always decrease by 1. And so the thing that arises from this construction is this arises also because we have we have the differential in the chain complexes, and then we have a differential in the algebra. So the differential in the algebra is going to slightly change the condition that a complex is a complex. So normally, we just want the differential to square to 0. But now we have this more complicated condition for A infinity algebras in general. If we have higher products, where say M1 would be differential, M2 would be multiplication. But luckily, we only have M1 and M2. And so this condition we want for the differential to square to 0 just becomes that partial delta plus delta squared equals 0, where, again, delta is the differential in the chain complex, and partial is the differential in the algebra. And so this condition will only hold up to signs. For the purposes of this presentation, I won't really address plus and minus signs because they're actually quite technical, but we can just think about working over Z2, and then one could work out all the correct signs. And so it's actually going to be using this condition that the differential squares to 0 that's going to allow us to figure out what this deformation is across the diagonal. So here's just one more example for how we find these one-dimensional resolutions. And then I'll show a two-dimensional example, which was one we'll have to use this deformation. So this would be the brain that corresponds to the Hopf link. I've already removed a strand. So that's why I have two more punctures than I do cups and caps. And then I could sort of translate this picture into a picture of brains. And we see that it's made of 6 thimbles. And I have these maps between them. And so I could just start with one of the thimbles, say the far left thimble, which will be T1. And I will follow the maps around this sort of diagram I made to get this chain complex, where I've explicitly written the homological degree in square brackets and the equivariant degree in curly brackets. And the way one finds these degrees is because the degrees of every map is already fixed by the algebra. So if I just say, choose to put thimble T1 in degree 0, 0, then the degrees of all other thimbles are fixed. And in such a way, I can write down this one-dimensional resolution. And then remember I said my I2 brain, this one on the previous page, is what's going to get me the homology. So I intersect with the I2 brain, and it simply picks out the two T2 terms in this complex. And this will recover the homology of the Hopf link, which will coincide with knot flower homology. And another thing, apart from signs of brushing under the rug, is the overall grading. And so there is a rather complicated way to figure out the overall grading of this theory that is well-defined. But for the purposes of this talk, I will, again, not leave that and just think about like projective invariance. But we do know how to fix the overall grading. And so if you'll recall from the definition of the algebra, I said the algebra differential act by uncrossing these two thimbles. And so we need at least two thimbles in order for the differential to have non-trivial action. And all my previous examples just had one thimble. So obviously, if we want knots with bridge number greater than 2, we'll need more than one oval brain. And so we'll need to think about how this differential acts. And this is when we'll see the deformation of the algebra. And so here is sort of the shortest toy example I can construct where we would see this property. It's just from this configuration of two brains, which we'll only need four thimbles to describe. So again, I would sort of draw it in terms of thimbles. And I'd want to first start by taking the resolutions of each of the two individual brains. So L1 is going to be the inside oval. We already saw what that resolution looks like. And so then we want to consider the product of L1 with our other two thimbles in that outer complex. So those are T2 and T4. And so in the differential, there isn't necessarily a unique term we could assign that say goes from T22 to T44, but the term we pick is actually fixed by geometry. So if we look back at our picture, we see that these maps of the inner oval don't actually cross past the thimbles of the outer T2 and T4, and so we know that there's not going to be a crossing in these strand diagrams. And so we have a complete recipe to go from this geometric picture to what these maps should be. And so finally, we want to turn on this last outer map from T2 to T4, and we'll arrive at this complex. And so this is what we would call the geometric differential, and this is also the differential on our space without the diagonal. And so we would find that this differential only satisfies our condition that partial delta plus delta squared equals 0 if we set h bar to 0. So it's only going to satisfy that equation if we're working with diagonal removed. But the way we turn back on the diagonal is we want to deform this differential in such a way that it actually satisfies our equation that it squares to 0, even with h bar being non-zero. And so we can see that, I guess, that it doesn't work by just acting the differential and uncrossing the strands. And so essentially, we want to guess an extra map that we can add to this differential that will make it satisfy this differential squares to zero equation. And so in this particular complex, I think there's only like one extra map we can add anyways. And so we can sort of add it with an arbitrary coefficient, solve for the equation partial delta plus delta squared equals 0, and then it will fix this coefficient. And so we find that this full resolution with the diagonal put back in is this complex I have shown here with this extra h-bar term. And then if we set h-bar to 0, we are back at the complex we started at. And so in this way, we found this non-trivial resolution of these brains. And then it turns out this additional map we turned on will actually correspond to a geometric disk. So this map we found at this deformation is one of these instanton corrections to the complex. And it would the domain of the disk would be the one shown in this picture. And so generically, we expect that these extra corrections we find in the complex will somehow correspond to these geometric disks that we're counting, which so we've basically found a nifty algebraic way to see what these disks will be without ever actually having to count a disk geometrically. So the approach to SU2 is simpler in some ways, but more complicated in other ways. Namely, SU2 does not have a differential, but it does have a more complicated algebra space in that we really want to be thinking of this product of cylinders I told you about Y as the subspace of some larger space script Y, which fibers over the base. And so we want to consider morphisms of thimbles in the total space rather than just in the base space. And so we could fully develop this theory, but luckily for us, there's a simple way to account for this total space, and that's by equipping our thimbles with a local system, thimbles in the base, little y, with a local system, and then also looking at morphisms of this like local system, which just will correspond to adding dots to our strand algebra. And so for Lie algebras, in general, this is going to be known as the KLRW algebra, and it's been studied by from the B-side perspective by Ben Webster. And then Aganagich, Danilenko, Lie, Shende, and Zhao have calculated it rigorously on the A-side in the upstairs theory, which will essentially prove homological mirror symmetry for these spaces. But for our purposes, we're just going to take this algebra and use it to construct resolutions. So here are the relations for SU2. I think there are a lot of them. They would all come from counting disks, but maybe some important things to point out. So there's going to be two divisors we care about now. One will be the divisor of the diagonal, which will still correspond to h-bar, and the other one will be the divisor of the punctures. So unlike in the GL11 case, we actually can have disks that pass through punctures, and these disks will coincide with this variable u. And so setting u equals 0 and h bar equals 0 will mean disks can't pass through the diagonal or pass through the punctures. So now we're going to have to find our complex in two steps, where we start with u equals 0, h bar equals 0, then we deform to allow disks to pass through the punctures, and we deform again to allow them to pass through the diagonal. And then you can see these dots are the dots I was talking about from this coming from this extra upstairs theory. And so those also, the dots arise when you allow disks to pass through punctures as well. So I said for SU2, the cups are now figure eight brains, and I can do the same sort of trick to write down a resolution. And then in this algebra, there's no differential. The Maslov degree of all the maps is just 0, so we just have ordinary complexes again. So in that sense, the theories for Lie algebras are simpler. It's only in the case of super Lie algebras that we have a non-trivial differential. So here's the resolution I have. And then if I want to get the homology of the unknot, I can just intersect with the I2 brain. And this will just pick out the two copies of T2. And there's no differential connecting them. So this would be the unknot homology. And this would recover the Jones polynomial, again, up to overall normalization. And so I'll sort of briefly explain how the deformations would work for the Hopf link. And so I should mention we don't have to cut a strand here to get something non-trivial. And so the Hopf link, I'd have these two brains. I'd break them up into our geometric pictures. And I can translate this geometric picture into a one-dimensional complex. And then I could say, translate the second geometric picture into a one-dimensional complex. And then finally, I can take the product of these two one-dimensional complexes, where now I've written it out in a grid, because I think this is slightly easier to digest, where I have the homological degree and then the square brackets again. And so perhaps I should mention that this is something that we can get Mathematica to do. So Mathematica can make these complexes for us. And I think the grids make it easier to encode in Mathematica. But basically, the idea of building this geometric complex is it basically just uses the construction for taking the product of two complexes, where the differential is essentially the same, and we only have to keep track of where the two thimbles will cross. And the crossing of the two thimbles is denoted by the purple maps, and that we can figure out also from the geometric picture. So this entire complex I can get just from looking at the pictures I showed you previously. And so this complex squares to 0 when u equals 0 and h bar equals 0. And so the next thing we want to do is look for the U deformations. This is just me writing it as a normal complex. And so as a normal complex, we would have, say, these first two terms. And then we could look for, say, these dotted corrections. So again, I could solve for this by demanding that I want, say, delta 5 times delta 6 t equals 0 when u is non-zero. So I would go, I'd find these corrections. And then again, the possible h bar corrections, all of these terms could hypothetically show up in my complex. But if I try and solve for these coefficients, I would get a system of equations. So for example, the fourth row of delta 5 times delta 6 would give me the equation I have shown here, which would tell me the values of x4 and x8. And so in this way, I could fix all of the unknown coefficients in this differential, all of the terms in the differential, and I would arrive at my final differential for all of the terms. And again, this is something that there's a way to encode all of this in Mathematica, so we're not actually having to do all of this by hand. And so we have this solved final differential. And so then if we take our previous complex, maybe I can go back a few slides to where I have this complex. And so intersecting with the I-brains, I want to pick out just the T24 thimbles. And these thimbles would be the thimbles contributing to knot homology. And so we'd see that there's 8 of them. And then the differential would give us some maps between them. And so after intersecting with I24, I would get this much simpler complex. And then the homology of this complex would be the SU2 homology of the Hopf link. And so this complex I have shown here is actually what's going to encode the disk counts. So we could probably find disks corresponding to all of these U H-bar terms in this complex. And all 8 of these terms will correspond to the 8 intersection points I showed you guys previously for the Hopf link. And then we recover the SU2 homology of the Hopf link. And so we have Mathematica code where we could do this for any knot hypothetically, but it eventually becomes too computationally intensive. But we can feed the program a braid, and it will spit out these complexes and their homology. And so one way to make it easier to solve in practice is to just to solve order by order in H-bar. So H-bar is this deformation. And so usually it's enough to solve for just the first order corrections, so just this delta 1 term, and then we'll find that that automatically makes the differential square root of 0. But in theory, we could have to go higher and higher. But what's nice about solving order by order in H-bar is that once we fix the solution of the differential for all, say, L less than k, then we just end up with a linear equation for the differential at order k. And so by iteratively expanding an H-bar, we're only ever solving a large system of linear equations. And so the ability of us to find a solution and find the resolutions of these brains just depends on how large a system of linear equations we're able to solve. What? The solution is unique up to quasi-isomorphism. So the actual solution Mathematica finds won't be unique, but it's equivalent.
How do you know that?
We have a proof of this by just... I guess I'm like less certain of the details. It is in the paper, but it's basically that any deformation of the differential turns out to have to be like the image of... Like it's like it has, it's trivial in like the homology of the theory.
It goes to the deformation for the bank itself.
What?
So these would be deformations for the bank itself.
Yeah, they would be, but they would be deformations that don't change the homology of the brain because those, yeah. And so we can also extend everything I said to other Lie algebras and super algebras.
So there's no reason for scans that are combining, things like that.
What?
There's no reason for scans that are combining.
So there's no reason, wait, sorry, so what?
There's no reason for scans that are combining somehow when you perform differential.
Yeah.
That's great.
Okay. So the generalization basically is just that we want punctures colored by pairs of highest weight and dual highest weight such that these DAs will control the number of thimbles you have. And so they want to be chosen to satisfy this particular equation, which comes from, if you think about the representation coming from the tensor product of highest weight mu with highest weight mu star, and you think about the weights you want to use to lower this to the zero vector in there. So those would be where the DAs come from. And so then your cups and caps will connect these punctures and dual punctures, and the DAs will control how many figure eights you have colored by the roots, and the intervals will have dots corresponding to these DAs. So I think if I show you some examples, this will make more sense maybe. So here I have examples for SU4, which I again has three roots. So my roots will be green, orange, and blue. And so if I choose the one of the punctures colored by representation with highest weight W1, that will be, say, green. And then the dual to that will be colored by W3. And so if I want to start with, say, a representation of W3 and construct this representation, I would start by lowering by E1, then by E2, which would be orange, and then by E3, which would be blue. And that would control the order of the punctures. But then if my punctures were, say, W2, this would be self-dual, so both punctures would be colored by W2. And then to construct this representation, I would first lower by E2, then I would lower by E1 and E3 in either order, and then E2. And so that will correspond to the order of the figure eights or the punctures I have shown here. And then I should mention that these figure eights and these punctures cannot, in general, commute in the same way that you can't lower in a different order. But for cases where you could switch the order, so when the roots aren't connected on the Dinkin diagram, so say for E1 and E3 here, I can actually exchange the blue and the green punctures when they are adjacent to each other. And so this is just combinatorially more intense to count the intersection points, but I want to count the intersection points of my brains such that I can line up the punctures with the figure eights in such a way that I don't actually change the ordering of the punctures or the figure eights in a forbidden way. So for SU4, I would have these four possible pictures. And then for GL(m/n), it would be sort of a combination of what I just told you for general Lie algebras and then what we know about GL(1,1). And so the upshot of this is it's basically the same, but any cups that are associated to fermionic roots will have an oval for that particular root. So for GL(2,1), if we're looking at the Dinkin diagram with one bosonic and one fermionic root, I have a figure eight for the bosonic root and an oval for the fermionic root. And then other things will be similar, but the potential and this holomorphic form will be unique for each group. And so this is just me saying that basically the computations extend the in theory more or less directly, but as you get to more complicated algebras, the computations become more intense because there's more things to account for. So I briefly want to talk about how we can prove topological invariance. And so for us, proving topological invariance amounts to proving these sort of analogs of Markov moves, but for braid closures. So these first two moves I have shown here, except for changes of framing, will be more or less manifest. So they'll just be exchanging two cups or caps or twisting a single cup or cap. But the non-trivial ones we want to prove This would be sort of passing a cup underneath another one. This would be adding another cup, twisting it with your braid, and then capping it off. And so we can prove these two moves at the level of chain complexes, just like we did with the brains. And so basically, what we want to do is we translate these cup and cap, these Markov moves, into pictures of cups and caps, where this negative one accounts for the change of framing. And then it turns out that both of these relations follow from a single relation, where we're allowed to slide a single thimble over a figure eight brain. And proving this last relation, we can just do using the resolutions and explicitly show that these two things are homotopy equivalent once we write down their resolutions. And then one could apply the same methods to prove it for GL11 using definitions of, say, homotopy equivalence and such adjusted for twisted complexes. And so we've done this proof for both SU2 and GL11 with all of the signs and all of the overall gradings worked out. And so we've proved that we do, in fact, get link invariance back in these two cases. And then hypothetically, we should be able to do this for any Lie algebra or superalgebra. But of course, because this proof only works in like a case-by-case basis, eventually we'll get to a point where the resolutions are just too complicated and we can't really proceed anymore. So as a summary, I reviewed Eigenagich's A-model formulation of link homology and explained how it extends to include Lie superalgebras. And I explained how we can actually explicitly compute these homologies by looking at resolutions of the brains by first starting on the theory with some divisor removed and then putting the divisor back in. I explicitly showed how this works for some groups, and I also gave a proof of topological invariance. So thank you.
So in terms of this proof of invariance,
yeah,
and now I need to remember what's in my own paper. But, I remember sort of the computational complexity doesn't get too bad, but it might be that you need to kind of allow yourself more general configurations that it might be easier if you somehow, because right, you're doing everything in terms of plot closures.
Yeah.
And there's this list of moves in Suki's book or frame tangles, which somehow I feel it doesn't get that bad if you kind of phrase it like everything that reminds me of some flexibility that you weren't giving yourself.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear. I think in particular just our resolutions get more complicated because for every additional root we get another figure eight, and every figure eight contributes four thimbles. Mm-hmm. So that sort of scales very badly because you're looking at products.
Right. All of the kind of moves you need to do are very difficult.
Yeah.
All
that
many
things. Yeah.
For GLM, the model perspective has to do with the model of column branches and behavior under some operations. Of column branches, of quivers, depending on four quivers. Do you have a similar perspective on the super group?
I don't personally, because I mostly think about the A side sort of as a group. We are working, and there's another grad student, and I think we're working on just understanding the B side, even for GL11, with the eventual hope. But that story hasn't at all been developed yet, so I can't really say anything.
And I talked a bit about this with me that this summer. And, you know, there's some issues, right, with like the GLMM. I mean, there is some RAIN configuration that gives it to you, but it's not N equals 4 super spectrum theory, it's only N equals 2. Coulomb branch is much smaller, but.
Well, you could have three theories that intersect along the line, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, something about some of the brains being, it had something to do with or something.
Any more questions?